Hi, I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening to Only a Game. There are thousands of podcasts out there. You chose this one. It's your thing. Listening choices are part of who you are. The choice to support your favorite NPR programs is yours as well. Visit donate.npr.org/game to donate to your station, then share why that's the kind of person you are. Tweet or create a public Facebook post with the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. When the National League was formed in the 1870s, baseball went from being a sport run by the players to a sport run by the businessmen who owned the teams. Over the next decade, those businessmen realized that competing to sign players was bad for business. They introduced the reserve clause. Players wouldn't successfully challenge the reserve clause until 1975, but they came close once before in 1890. Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
Earlier this year, in March, Joe Tomasulo, the East Coast consignment director for the sports memorabilia auction house Memory Lane, was in White Plains, New York for a trade show.
It's the JPRS Rock Solid Sports Show.
That's Joe. He set up his table near the front door of the convention center. It's his usual spot.
A gentleman walked in with his wife with an accordion file. Said he wanted to show me some rare documents that he's held for many years.
Joe won't tell me the names of the gentleman and his wife. Like most of Joe's consigners, they've chosen to remain anonymous for reasons that are also undisclosed.
I'm being very vague here, but I think you get the point. It's a privacy issue.
What Joe will say is that the gentleman is a retired contractor, and he acquired the documents on the job sometime in the mid-90s.
They were unearthed from a desolate New York office building, upstate New York. The wooden floors were termite-ridden, so they basically had to replace the floors with cement. There was a particular storage room with a bunch of boxes. So he just went directly to the owner of the building. What do I do with this stuff? He told them to keep it, throw it out, do whatever you want. Just get rid of it. So he didn't have the time to go through all these boxes. He just took what he thought was interesting.
And the rest went into the trash.
Correct. God knows how many historical signatures, documents were thrown away. Sad.
Joe started thumbing through the documents.
And I'm seeing John Ward's name and Tim Keefe and Buck Ewing.
These names were familiar to Joe Tomasulo. They're very early Hall of Famers and some of the most sought-after autographs in the baseball world.
This is a point I can't stress enough. There's a handful of those Hall of Fame signatures currently existing in the hobby. A couple of Keefes, a couple of Ewings, maybe a few more Ward, maybe four or five Wards. All I'm thinking to myself is, this is a dream. This is an autograph collector's dream.
But Joe noticed something else about these documents. The team names were from the 1890 Players League. Joe had heard of the Players League before, but in all of his decades working in the hobby, he had never come across documents like these. He's seen a couple of baseball cards, but that's it.
They're basically unique.
As Joe was thumbing through the pile, he came across one particular document, a single piece of paper dated February 2nd, 1891, and signed by four shareholders of one of these Players League teams.
I'm thinking to myself, the Queen Mary has pulled in.
Joe's excitement is monetary. He believes that document to be worth a lot of money. But I'm fascinated by it because of what it represents. Let's explain.
So going back to 1889, to make it simple, players back then were treated like mere sheep.
They were held to what was called the reserve clause, which meant that every season your contract would expire and your team would offer you a new contract and you could either sign the contract or you would be banned from baseball.
That's W.M. Akers.
I write about baseball history and I also write fiction.
And this story, the story of the 1890 Players League, reads like a work of fiction. Because in the late 1800s, owners had all the control, and they knew it. They could pay the players whatever they wanted, fine them for anything, literally anything.
There was one team that was almost insolvent, and so the owner started fining the players for every loss. And by the end of the season, he'd fine them so much that he was able to recoup their entire salaries.
And then along came John Montgomery Ward.
He's the only man in history to collect 100 wins and 2,000 hits.
Ward wasn't just a great player. He was also a really smart guy. He studied law at Columbia. And in 1885, he founded a secret society. He called it the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players.
It's what today we would call a labor union, although they were very, very careful to avoid using that term because it was pretty incendiary.
Within a year, 90% of the National League players had joined, and the Brotherhood went public.
Ward's big target was the reserve clause, and he wanted to give his players the right to negotiate freely with what we would today call free agency.
The owners were wary of the Brotherhood, at least at first. They made a few concessions, but then took them back. Ward needed a way to get close to one of the owners, to bend his ear. After the 1888 season, A.G. Spalding, owner of the franchise in Chicago, arranged for an around-the-world baseball barnstorming tour to spread the love of the game and sell sporting goods. Ward saw an opportunity.
He felt like maybe if Spalding and I are alone on a boat for several weeks, maybe I can talk to him, I can show him that, hey, the reserve clause is not good for us or for you. Let's move this game into the future together.
So Spalding and Ward boarded a ship bound for Hawaii, Australia, then Cairo, Paris, and London. But
3 days after they set sail, the National League enacted what was called the Brush Classification Plan.
The Brush Plan was essentially a salary cap. Players were graded from A to E. Top players were grade A, and under this plan, they would make $2,500, which was half of what they'd earned the year before. Grade E players would make just $1,500, and
if the owners wanted to, they could force a grade E player to sweep the ballpark. That was very important to them.
News of the Brush Plan didn't reach John Montgomery Ward until months later, when Spalding's barnstorming tour reached Cairo. And if Ward was upset, he didn't let the press know.
Basically, he refused to comment. He sort of bided his time.
When the tour reached Paris, Ward headed back to New York, telling Spalding in the press that he had some personal business to attend to.
This was not a lie. He was married to a Broadway actress, and his marriage was kind of falling apart. In addition, he went home to try to deal with his union and this salary cap.
The Brotherhood was furious. Many wanted to call for an immediate strike.
Ward would say, "Let's not do anything yet, let's not do anything yet, let's not do anything yet."
What Ward didn't say, at least at first, was that he had a much bigger plan to take down the reserve clause.
Rather than do like a one-off strike right now, which would really just poison the fans against him, he wanted to get together enough money to actually start an entire independent baseball league.
So every time Ward's team went on a road trip, he'd meet with investors in major league cities. His pitch was simple. How'd you like to own a baseball team? Turns out there was plenty of interest.
So on July 14th, which is happily Bastille Day, they voted on a secret manifesto to declare, quote, "We have determined to play next season under different management."
But news of their secret manifesto leaked out, and soon everyone knew what was about to be announced.
So it's November 4th, 1889, and the players get together at the Fifth Avenue Hotel, which was the deluxe Manhattan Society Hotel. And this is sort of, in some ways, the high point of the entire experiment, because this is when the players, after years and years and years of getting kicked around by ownership, really get to thumb their noses at them and say, "That's it. You're not going to hire us for your league. We don't care. We're done."
King Kelly, a slugger for Boston, showed up, according to newspaper reports, wearing a tight-fitting pair of imported trousers, a tall silk hat, and a beaver overcoat. He stopped to talk to the press outside the hotel and taunted the owners of his former team by saying,
"Listen, if you want a job next season, I'll give you a job taking tickets at the turnstiles." And then he tells the reporters, "Goodbye, I'm going inside to manipulate the wires that will startle the baseball world."
Was that just bravado, or did these guys really think that this thing was going to work?
I think they did think that it was going to work, and I wouldn't call it a doomed experiment from the start. I think that there was a very, very good chance that the Players League could have succeeded, mainly because more than half of the players in the National League jumped ship, and most of the top players came, including guys like Buck Ewing, Monty Ward, Tim Keefe.
The Players League placed most of its teams in major cities, where a National League team was already playing.
And I think that if things had broken the other way, we could be watching Players League baseball every week instead of National League baseball.
But things didn't break the other way. To field competitive teams, both leagues poached players from a third league playing baseball in 1890, the American Association.
You had three baseball leagues going, and none of them could field a really top-notch team. So it was sort of like there was too much baseball, and most of it wasn't very good.
The American Association folded. The Players League might have made it back for the 1891 season if not for Buck Ewing, the player manager of the New York team.
Both of the New York clubs were suffering, so the Giants have a secret meeting with Ewing after the season ends, and they say, listen, this is bad for all of us. Why don't you just quit?
And that's just what Ewing did. The two New York teams announced that they would merge and play in the National League. Soon, the other clubs followed suit.
It fell apart extremely quickly.
Much of this story is told through the documents unearthed in that upstate New York office building, from the unsigned draft of the league's constitution to the bill authorized for payment by John Montgomery Ward for the printing of 400 player contracts. But then there's Joe Tomasulo's Queen Mary, a letter signed by stockholders he's hoping will fetch the highest price in Memory Lane's upcoming auction. That one was signed by future Hall of Famers Buck Ewing and Tim Keefe on February 2nd, 1891. In it, Ewing and Keefe call for a meeting to discuss paying off the team's debts and acknowledge, as shareholders, that those funds would most likely come out of their own pockets. But WM Akers says that wasn't the worst part.
As soon as the Players League died and then the American Association followed soon after, owners responded by taking full advantage of the reserve clause to slash salaries.
It didn't work out for the Players League, but it just might work out for that retired contractor and his wife, though Joe Tomasulo didn't tell them that right away.
You know, you don't want to shoot for the moon right out of the gate.
Joe says the document signed by John Montgomery Ward will likely go for $15,000 to $20,000. Tim Keefe and Buck Ewing's signatures are worth more, maybe $25,000 to $50,000. But what about the Queen Mary, that letter signed by both Keefe and Ewing?
I couldn't even begin to put a price tag on it. I will say this, I would be disappointed if it fell anything less than six figures.
The consigners, that retired contractor and his wife, would probably be disappointed too. Did the consigners tell you at all what they planned to do with the money?
No. Other than, I think he had mentioned a couple of new kitchen utensils. They're redoing their kitchen. But other than that, no.
That's Joe Tomasulo speaking with Only a Game's Karen Given. We'll have links to Memory Lane's auction, which opens on December 22nd, and WM Akers' baseball dice game Dead Ball at onlyagame.org. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Granny Cack for leaving the following review on Apple Podcasts. I'm a woman in my 70s. I've never been a sports fan. I don't watch games. I don't read the sports section in the paper, but I really enjoy listening to Only a Game. They don't yell at each other or the listeners. There is intelligent humor, and the presenters and producers know when to take sports seriously and when to have fun with it. I especially love the segment with Charlie Pierce. Keep it up. Thanks, Granny Cack. We'll keep the shows coming, and we hope listeners like you will keep posting reviews on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever they get their podcasts. It really does help other listeners to find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. The Winter Olympics begin in 2 months in South Korea. Who will be there and who will not? That's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Cindy Boren of The Washington Post and Jason Gay of The Wall Street Journal. Welcome back to both of you.
Hi, Bill.
Bill, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I'm going to go first because there was so much Olympics news this week. On Tuesday, the IOC barred the Russian Olympic team from competing at the Games. You may remember that the Russians had a systematic doping program. Russian athletes will be able to compete as individuals. They will wear a neutral uniform, whatever that means. And then on Wednesday, the American ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley, said that whether the U.S. would send athletes to the Olympics in South Korea was an open question. What would it be like if neither Russia nor the U.S. sent athletes to the Olympics? Jason, what do you think?
Well, my question is simply, would NBC just show old episodes of Friends? This is effectively a television show. Is it not the Olympics in modern times? And without the participation of the United States and its chief rival, I don't know if they have much to sell. It really was a ridiculous, ridiculous week for the Olympics. And quite frankly, when I heard Ambassador Haley throw out the possibility of the United States maybe not attending these games, I kind of felt like I was sliding into a warm bath. Yes, I knew this was coming. This is a political football now. Forget about the fact that it's not Ambassador Haley's decision. It is the United States Olympic Committee, which accepts and takes the delegation there. But why not drag this out into some sort of drama for the next 2 months?
Right. Every single time the Olympics is held, it's, oh, the venues aren't ready. The city's a disaster, you know, and then the Olympics go off because, as Jason said, it's a TV show. The games go on. So I'm not really terribly concerned just yet about any of this.
Yeah, you're right. This is historically consistent with how things go with the Olympics. Cindy, what's on your mind this week?
Well, what's on my mind this week is the NFL and how over the last six or so weeks, maybe 4 weeks, we've seen a bunch of really brutal, ugly events happen in games. On Monday night between the Bengals and the Steelers, there were a couple of hard hits. You had players getting into scrapes with one another. There was the injury to Ryan Shazier. No one watches football without the understanding and the acceptance that they're watching what can be a very brutal game. But at some point, we all decide, you know, how much can we take? And I think the Monday night game between the Steelers and the Bengals had a lot of people thinking, I really can't take any more of this. I agree with Mike Mitchell of the Steelers that no one really wants to see flag football, but this is really getting ugly, especially, for instance, the Gronkowski hit. You know, they have uneven discipline, uneven officiating on the field, and the only answer they seem to have for any of their problems seems to be give Roger Goodell more money and bring him on for another 4 or 5 years.
You know, we have to sort of drill down to the uncomfortable truth here and ask ourselves, to what degree is the violence, is the full contact part of the primal appeal of what makes the NFL the NFL? And, you know, when players bemoan, you know, penalties and the game becoming flag football and not being able to touch the quarterback, they're speaking to something that not just the players talk about, but some of the fan base as well. And as unbelievably awful it was to watch some of those moments. I was struck by, you know, on Thursday night, we just turned the page right away. You had Atlanta and New Orleans in a big game playing, and people just move on. And, you know, we've seen some ratings attrition for the NFL, but listen, any other sport would kill for the ratings of football. So it really is sort of this uncomfortable conversation that needs to happen about whether or not these things that people find so repellent publicly are, in fact, part of what drives the interest.
I was interested to see this week two very different opinions. A lot of retired players have spoken up in favor of the NFL's new rules, which, whether or not they do protect players, I'm not sure, but they're supposedly designed to protect the players. And then several current players are saying, hey, leave us alone. We signed up to play football, as you say, not flag football. People want to see us hit and get hit, and that's what it's all about. Cindy, what do you think? Is this just more of the same, or are we really seeing something different over the last month or two?
I think we're seeing something a little different. And, you know, we'll see next year. I get email from fans all the time saying, I'm never watching another NFL game. I'm not buying tickets next year. When it's time for fans to buy tickets, that's when we'll see if there are any ramifications or not. I think there could be a watershed moment here.
Okay, Jason, you are last this week, but certainly not least. Off you go.
I'm fine with being leased. we all know that the most highly compensated job in America is no longer stockbroker or heart surgeon or CEO. It's college football coach. We've seen the salaries. They're spectacular. Jimbo Fisher just left Florida State to go to Texas A&M. Have you seen the salary package? 10 years, $35 billion a year. I mean, it's just out of control. But I'm not here to talk about the head coaches, Bill and Cindy. I'm here to talk about the assistants. Let me give you some data points. And to here, I have to tip the cap to a guy named Steve Berkowitz at USA Today, who's kind of the czar of following coaching salaries in college sports. Just two assistant football coaches in 2012 were making more than $1 million. This year, there are 15. This is a spectacular rise. You know, it's to the point when your college football assistants are making more than your university presidents. I think it's time for a recalibration.
Cindy, are you ready to redo your resume and send it out to everybody looking for an assistant coach?
Yes, I have my whistle, and I'm ready. I'm sorry. I'm going to disagree just a little tiny bit here. I'm actually okay with the assistant coaches finally getting paid because, you know, these are the guys who really do the work. When you've got a head coach making $7, $8, $11 million a year, that's obscene, especially at a state school. I'm with that. I don't have a problem with some of the money filtering down to the assistant coaches.
I have to say, this is a market at work. It's not exactly a free market because a free market would assume that labor was getting paid. So, yeah, but it's a market. And as long as the boosters, the athletic directors, the university presidents, and the rest, in that order, by the way, believe that you can't get a good head coach for less than $8 million and a good assistant for less than $1.5 million, the market is going to continue to endure and prevail, as silly as the results might seem anywhere outside an economics classroom.
I guess, Bill, if I live long enough, I can experience an NPR commentator talking to a Wall Street Journal columnist about the free market. But this is not a free market. This is a constrained market.
Of course it is.
This is a constrained market where, as you mentioned, labor is shut off from it, and so excess revenue flows into the people who are taking a chunk of it.
Right, exactly. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Cindy Bourne of The Washington Post and Jason Gay, who reminded me that it's he who writes for The Wall Street Journal and not me. Thank you very much, Cindy.
Thanks, Bill.
And Jason, thanks very much.
Thanks kindly, Bill.
It's 1928. The setting is Thornton Township High School, which isn't far from the train line that serves Harvey, Illinois. 16-year-old Betty Robinson leaves school and realizes that if she doesn't hurry, she'll miss the train.
And it just so happens her science teacher was waiting for the same train.
That's Roseanne Montillo, who's researched the story of Betty Robinson. That science teacher, a fellow named Charles Price, was a former runner and coach of the boys' track team, and he recognized that the girl running for the train was pretty fast, but not, he thought, fast enough to catch it.
And when he got into the train, as the door closed, he was really surprised to find this young woman, Betty, sitting right next to him. So he knew that he had someone really, really special on his hands.
There was no girls' track team at Thornton Township High, but when Price suggested to Robinson that she let him time her as she ran down one of the corridors at the high school, she probably didn't need much convincing. She was a happy-go-lucky kid who played the guitar and acted in the school plays. Her father was a banker. She had a supportive family, delighted to see her succeed, apparently without effort, at whatever she tried. Within a few months of outrunning Charles Price's expectations, Betty Robinson qualified for the 1928 Olympic Games in Amsterdam. Her timing couldn't have been better. Before 1928, the Olympics hadn't included track and field events for women. Women could swim, they could compete at archery, they couldn't run. And after they reached Amsterdam in 1928, some of them still couldn't run.
The U.S. team got a little bit carried away on the ship. There was a little bit of booze going around, and there was a lot of food. Especially, they were partial to ice cream. They really indulged. So they ended up gaining an awful lot of weight.
Perhaps because Betty Robinson was only 16, the ice cream didn't slow her down. Good metabolism, maybe. Anyway, she was the only U.S. runner to qualify for the final of the 100 meters, which still didn't mean getting to the starting line for that race was a sure thing.
She had two pairs of running shoes with her. Instead of grabbing the correct pair of shoes, she ended up grabbing two lefties instead of a right and a left. So someone had to send a person to grab the correct pair of shoes, and they barely made it on time for her to end up at the starting line.
The gun went off. 12.2 seconds later, the first Olympic 100-meter dash for women was history. It looked to fans of the Canadian team as if their star, Fanny Rosenfeld, had broken the tape.
And the Canadians were celebrating. The Canadians were throwing their girl up in the air. And even Betty had figured it out that she had come in second. And she was thrilled with that until the numbers went up. And she had won the first gold to be given to a track and field woman.
Shortly after that, Robinson, who'd initially seen running as a lark, began to take what she'd accomplished more seriously.
When she returned from the 1928 Olympics, Betty had set out sort of a roadmap that she wanted to follow. 1928, she won her gold. 1932, she would win a second medal, gold, of course. I mean, what else would you win? And in 1936, she would go on to be a coach, or maybe things didn't go so well, she would be an assistant coach. Something terrible like that.
It might have worked out just that neatly if Betty Robinson hadn't decided on one hot afternoon during the summer of 1931 to interrupt her training with a ride in an airplane. Her cousin Will, an experienced pilot, assured her it would be cooler up among the clouds, and maybe for a time it was.
People still don't know how it happened, but the plane that they were piloting suddenly stalled just outside of Chicago, and they plunged to the ground.
Will survived, though his legs were crushed. When Betty was found, she was unresponsive. She was bleeding from a head wound.
The man who found her believed her to be dead, and he took her not to the hospital, but to an undertaker.
One of Betty's legs was twisted, broken in three places. Her left arm had been shattered. There was a deep gash over her right eye. But the undertaker was an observant fellow. He noticed Betty was breathing. Still, the first doctors who saw her said she might not walk again, let alone run. During the weeks after she finally left the hospital, Betty often didn't want to get out of bed. Her brother-in-law had other ideas.
And so every morning he would wake her up and just go and take her for a walk. And initially it was just a couple of steps outside, maybe go down the street. And eventually he would make her run just a few steps in time. Those few steps turned out to be a short run around the block.
It would be great fun if running around the block had led directly to sprinting 100 meters, but it didn't. Betty began training harder, then a little harder still, on a rehab program that would last for most of the next 5 years. But her injuries prevented her from getting into the crouch that sprinters must assume at the start of a race.
The 100 meters was gone. She had to adjust her sight on maybe becoming part of a team.
As long as she wasn't the first runner on a relay team, she wouldn't have to crouch.
Once she had that moment of realization, it had a huge impact on her state of mind. It also had a huge impact on how she saw the sport and how she saw her teammates as well. Before, she hadn't really given an awful lot of thought about it. They were just girls. But now, these were women who made huge sacrifices to get to where they were, and she would have to be one of them.
Competition for the U.S. team that would go to the 36 Olympics in Berlin was stiffer than it had been in 1928, and that wasn't the only obstacle Betty Robinson faced. The U.S. Olympic Committee funded the men's track and field team, but they told Robinson and some of the other women to come up with their own travel money.
Her medical bills had taken a huge toll on the family. Her father had lost his job at the bank. The Great Depression was in full swing. She had to sell pretty much all she owned.
Betty Robinson sold the ribbons and pins she'd collected at the 28 Games. Though she held on to her gold medal, she found work as a secretary and saved what she could. It turned out to be enough. She made it to Berlin, and apparently it was evident that she was happy about that. The New York Times nicknamed her Smiling Betty. But she wasn't in Berlin to smile. She was there to run.
She knows that this is likely her last Olympics. She has this feeling that she's meant to be there at that particular moment in time.
Betty was the third runner in the 4x100 relay. By the time the baton came to her, the German team had taken the lead, a lead triumphantly reported on this German newsreel. Betty kept it close, and shortly after she passed the baton to Helen Stevens, who would run the final 100 meters, Robinson and her teammates got the break of a lifetime. Ilse Dorfeld, Germany's anchor runner, unaccountably broke a rule relay runners learn early. She tried to shift the baton from one hand to the other. She dropped it. Helen Stevens raced by her. The U.S. team won, and Betty Robinson had a second gold medal. Robinson eventually married a businessman named Richard Schwartz. They had two children and lived quietly. In 1971, the U.S. Olympic Committee inducted Betty Robinson into their Hall of Fame. Roseanne Montillo thinks the USOC got it a little wrong.
I think she should have been honored many years earlier than that. She opened up the doors for all track and field athletes. She showed that track and field could be fun, could be glamorous, could be dramatic. It could be viewed as something viable for young ladies.
True enough. At least for young ladies determined to overcome a plane crash, the prognosis that they'd never walk again, and whatever the depression could toss at them, because Betty Robinson did all that. You can learn more about Betty Robinson and some of her contemporaries from Roseanne Montillo's new book, Fire on the Track. The friendship between the U.S. and Canada doesn't go back as far as you might think.
The Speaker of the House actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's how unfriendly we were as late as 1911.
Just ahead, how a turning point in U.S.-Canadian relations helped produce an historic hockey program. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Erica Lance, and I think you might like this podcast I produce, also from WBUR, called Kind World. Kind World tells deeply personal stories about the pivotal moments in our lives.
She called me one day and she says, "Why are you choosing to live in our grief?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm choosing to live in your love."
All of those women were witness to the darkest and probably most intimate moment of my life, and they gave me a sliver of light.
I talked to all kinds of people about times when they felt alone or scared or overwhelmed and how they got through it with the help of others.
I even thought I was a little crazy, but then I'm like, wait, I could do anything I want. I could raise $1 million if I want to. I could cure this disease.
I think that he bypassed all that and just said, "I see a human being who needs my help and I'm going to help him."
Head over to WBUR.org/kindworld. Or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, stories about the grandest of gridiron innovations, the forward pass. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Tuesday, the IOC suspended the Russian Olympic Committee from participating in the 2018 South Korea Winter Games. But the Games will include athletes from Russia. They just won't be competing as Russian athletes. Have I got that right?
Yeah, apparently so. The IOC summoned up, went to the dollar store and bought some integrity and decided to take it on a parade down the main streets of the city. This was the investigation of the highly sophisticated, highly organized, and probably government-run doping program that the Russians were running. You know how I feel about this whole thing. I am unmoved by the cock-a-doodle-doos of moral triumph here. I'm glad some of them will get to compete, though. And for them, I'm glad that Vladimir Putin has decided that he'll be okay with them participating.
At least so far.
Yeah.
If the athletes who live in Russia win medals, do they get to take them home to Russia?
I guess. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they have to stay in Athens or something.
I don't know. Roger Goodell will remain the commissioner of the NFL. He signed a new 5-year contract this week that could be worth up to $200 million. It is, as they say, incentive-laden, and as far as I know, he did not get the use of a private jet or lifetime health care for himself and his family. So, is he a winner or a loser?
I think he's doing okay. 6 months ago, you'd wondered if they were going to sign him at all, but he seems to have tamped down the rebellion, and Jerry Jones seems to be properly sedated. So off we go with Roger Goodell to kick around for the 5 years.
Eli Manning is a starting quarterback again.
Who cares? Just
1 week after the team benched him, ending his 210-game streak of consecutive starts. And all it took was for the guys who'd benched him to be fired.
Hey, so, you know.
Nobody's going to stop the Giants now.
And all over America, frustrated middle managers are going, yes! That's the way we do business. No, it was a genuine New York tabloid back page frenzy for about a week. You know, it's helped immeasurably by the fact that the Giants really stink this year.
Yeah.
But I mean, Eli Manning gets to walk out if he does walk out on his own 2 feet and as the starter, and that's fine.
Okay, we have our bowl matchups.
I have in my hand. Look at this. Listen to him. That's a heavy bunch of paper.
Yeah, it's the bowl matchups. Yep. Finalists for the big college football championship. Who do you like?
I think Alabama's going to be playing very, very angry. I'd like to see Wisconsin win. I don't think they're fast enough to stay on the field with these guys. I'm going to pick Alabama.
The Heisman Trophy.
Hold it.
Very nicely done.
Thank you.
The pose was eloquently and perfectly, I would say, replicated. Anyway, the Heisman buzz this year included news of how one of the guys who gets to vote was crowing about having that opportunity, and that would be?
That would be newly released convict O.J. Simpson.
Apparently,
they never took his Heisman vote away. If you've won the Heisman, you get to vote for the rest of your life. They took Reggie Bush's Heisman vote away, and he didn't steal no memorabilia at gunpoint.
The NBA says it is considering adding a team in Mexico, albeit to the G League, formerly known as the Developmental League. I like the idea. Team in Mexico.
Well, we'll see if it sells. I mean, the NBA itself sells in Mexico, but we'll see if the minor league does.
And then how long before there's one in Cuba?
Well, I have a feeling that if the G League team draws 9 people to every game, the NBA will declare it a success and then put a team in Mexico City. I'm fairly sure of that.
The Forbes list of most valuable NHL teams is in. Any surprises there?
A little bit. I think the Rangers being the most valuable team is a little bit of a surprise. Toronto and Montreal are 2 and 3. I suppose given the nature of all things being bigger in New York, it shouldn't surprise me, but it actually does.
Yeah, Toronto was always the one,
yeah.
I thought. Tiger Woods played well at last weekend's Hero World Challenge, and the odds of Mr. Woods winning the 2018 Masters have shot from 100 to 1 to 15 to 1. I don't know if playing well at one tournament should cause that dramatic shift in the odds.
Well,
what do you think?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It depends on what the environmental factors on Hero World were. I mean, I have to go to Hero World sometime.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody must dress in costumes. But you know,
I'd be the Flash.
I would have taken Tiger Woods at 100 to 1. I don't think I'd take him at 15 to 1. You can't make any money.
Charlie, perhaps we should offer a tip of the goalie mask to 9-year-old Caden Whaley. He took time after the first period of a recent game to coach the opposing goalie. Caden's team was up by 7 goals. The other kid had let in 7. And he was kind of a rookie. He'd never played in the goal before. Nice for the kid.
He never even
that.
Worn the equipment before.
No, no.
Which is, you know, strange enough. If, I mean, what, you all of a sudden you weigh 900 pounds and you're 8 feet wide.
Exactly.
but good for Caden. He came over and helped the young man out, showed him how to move and how to position himself. And apparently, I don't know if the kid's goaltending got any better, but he felt a lot more comfortable out there. And I think at that age, that's all that matters.
And finally, Charlie, the Milwaukee Public Library runs a series it calls Loud Library Days. And last week, a few very colorful characters helped them in making some noise. Who were those?
It was the wrestling family Mondo Lucha, which brought a card to the library. I just caught myself.
And it wasn't a library card.
No, it wasn't. There were 500 tickets available ahead of time, and they went instantly, apparently.
Of course they did. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
It's Michigan! And the Wolverines are the national champions!
What if I told you that the most successful hockey program in U.S. history owes its existence to a Canadian who grew up hating the United States and to one of the largest explosions in history?
Incredibly, it is fair to say that.
That's John Bacon, who's researched the founding of the University of Michigan hockey program. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has our story.
Picture the House chamber at the U.S. Capitol. It's 1911, and the Speaker of the House, a guy named Champ Clark, takes the floor and says,
"I look forward to the time when the American flag will fly over every square foot of British North America up to the North Pole."
The Speaker of the House, the Paul Ryan of his day, actively advocates for the annexation of Canada. That's his whole point.
That's John Bacon again.
He received loud cheers and a great write-up in the Washington Post. So that's how unfriendly we were as late as 1911.
The U.S. obviously did not try to annex Canada. Sometimes you just gotta realize the Speaker of the House has a bad idea, you know? Anyways, north of the border, lots of people were not too fond of the U.S. Joseph Bars, the guy at the center of this story, was 19 years old in 1911, and he had basically been born to hate the United States. It was in his blood. His ancestors had once lived in Massachusetts, but fled to Nova Scotia as tensions rose between the colonists and England.
They were loyal to the crown and not to the rebels, the revolutionaries, of course.
When the Revolutionary War started, Bars' great-great-grandfather fought on the British side. But Bars was named after his great-grandfather, who was even more fearsome.
He captures, burns, or sinks more than 60 American ships during the War of 1812, so much so that he becomes the most wanted man in America. And that is our hero's great-grandfather.
Joseph Bars grew up in Wolfville, Nova Scotia. He was just 5'8", but he was strong. He starred on the hockey team at Acadia University. Not long after graduation, he found a personal reason to hate the United States. In 1915, he gave up a comfortable job in Montreal to join the Canadian Army in the trenches of World War I. He was angry that the United States wasn't yet sending troops. Soon he had bigger problems. At the Battle of Mont Sorel in 1916, a German trench mortar nearly killed him. Bars was in a body cast for 6 months, then returned to Wolfville, about an hour from Halifax, to recuperate. The man who'd once been strong enough to do a lap around the rink on unlaced ice skates now struggled to move his left foot.
He comes back and he's kind of a lost soul, essentially. He does not want to go back to Montreal and be a businessman. He does not want to take over his dad's grocery store, which his dad thought he would. So he's lost, looking for a sense of purpose, and he finds it by accident.
In November 1917, Russia dropped out of the war. This meant the Germans could focus on the Western Front, and that made the Allies very nervous. They decided they needed more firepower. A French freighter called the Mont Blanc went to New York to stock up on airplane fuel and explosives. Then it headed north to meet a convoy in Halifax that would then leave for Europe. The Mont Blanc was packed with 6 million pounds of TNT and another explosive called picric acid.
That is 13 times the weight of the Statue of Liberty, and they're so nervous about it that they cover their boots with canvas covers to make sure they don't spark on deck. You're not allowed to have matches on your person anywhere near the ship, and in a smoking era, that's a four-day sacrifice these French guys are not used to. So that's how terrified they are of this thing blowing up, and it crawls up the coast to Halifax.
German U-boats had already sunk 3,000 Allied ships, so the Mont Blanc crew was itching to get into Halifax Harbor.
These guys are terrified of getting blown up. Another ship, the Emo, a Norwegian supply ship, it's already a day late and wants to get to New York to load up with various relief supplies. They have no idea what Mont Blanc has got on it. Only like 5 guys in the harbor who aren't on the ship know about this. Emo is in a hurry that morning, and it keeps on passing ships on the left. That is against nautical convention.
Both the Mont Blanc and the Emo reached the narrows of the Halifax Harbor at the same time, heading right at each other.
And Mont Blanc thinks this guy is crazy. He has one blast on the horn, which means I'm in the right place, you need to move. And Emo comes back with 2 blasts, saying, screw you, I'm going this way. Finally, at the last second, Mont Blanc realizes this guy's crazy, so it bails to the left, to the middle of the harbor, just as Emo does the same thing.
They collided. It wasn't a big collision, but it was enough to knock over barrels of airplane fuel on the Mont Blanc.
and the stuff ignites, and the crew knows they're about to blow up. So they hop in their rowboats and go the other way, away from Halifax, crucially. Instead of warning anybody, they go to the woods of Dartmouth, and they run into the woods as far as they can.
The ghost ship, now on fire, continued toward Pier 6 in Halifax Harbor. On land, one of the guys who knew what the Mont Blanc was carrying started hollering that the ship was going to blow and everyone needed to run. A train dispatcher named Vincent Coleman heard the message and started to run for his life.
And then he stops because he remembers that the number 10 train from New Brunswick is coming in 5 minutes. It's going to park right in front of Pier 6. And if it does, everyone's going to die. So he runs back to the telegram office and starts furiously clacking off these messages to other train stations saying the following: hold up the train. Ammunition ship afire in harbor, making for Pier 6 and will explode. Guess this will be my last message. Goodbye, boys. And those are his last words.
At 9:04 in the morning, the Mont Blanc exploded.
This is a miniature atomic bomb. Human beings were flown half a mile in all directions. In that split second, 25,000 people are homeless, half the city is gone, 9,000 are wounded, and 2,000 are dead.
For the next 3.5 hours, all the telegraph lines in Halifax were down. But thanks to that final message from Vincent Coleman, word started to spread. And that's how Joseph Bars and the people in Wolfville got the news.
A doctor friend of his says, you know first aid, you gotta come and help me.
Bars, still walking with a cane, boarded the next train for Halifax and ended up at Camp Hill Hospital. The hospital was packed. There were so many people in need of help that doctors ran out of anesthesia. They kept operating. For the next 14 straight hours, Bars dressed wounds, set fractures, and even helped with surgeries, something he'd never done before. Meanwhile, Vincent Coleman's message had also gotten to Boston. The Massachusetts governor called an emergency meeting and, without waiting to hear back from anyone in Halifax, decided to send a train filled with doctors, nurses, and medical supplies. Meanwhile, Bars kept working in the hospital. After about 3 days, he was finally relieved by the doctors from Boston. One Nova Scotia historian wrote, "Substantial help was on the way from Toronto and Montreal, but the first and most valuable assistance came from that ancient foe beyond the Bay of Fundy."
And that is when the U.S. and Canadian relationship starts to change, and very dramatically. And Bars himself, very anti-American for a lot of reasons, he says, "I will never be able to say enough about the wonderful help the states have sent. The response was so spontaneous and everything done even before it was asked for. It brought tears to all our eyes. You know, we've always been a trifle contemptuous of the United States, but never again. They can have anything I've got, and I don't think I feel any differently from anyone else down here either."
On the train ride back to Wolfville, Bars, the man who'd been so lost, realized what he wanted to do with his life. He would become a doctor. And instead of going to a Canadian university, Bars enrolled at the University of Michigan. There, he started to skate at Michigan's Coliseum. This was the steel and concrete three-walled building that housed the hockey rink. Bars slowly made his way around the ice, trying to regain control of his foot. By 1922, he was healthy enough to referee the club hockey team's games.
And finally, he walks down to the athletic director's office, Fielding Yost, who built the big house in Ann Arbor, one of the most legendary coaches out there. And Bars says, "You need a hockey program." Yost is from West Virginia and born in 1871, the son of a Confederate soldier. So this guy does not know a damn thing about hockey, rest assured. But he saw something in Bars that he must have liked. And Fielding Yost says, "Only if you're the first coach." And he gives them the full rein and the funding for it. So that is how the University of Michigan got hockey.
For the next 5 years, Bars shuttled between his med school classes and the hockey rink. He coached Michigan to 2 league titles. The team was popular, and that early success mattered. When the Great Depression hit, many schools in the Midwest dropped their hockey programs, but not Michigan. The Wolverines have since gone on to win 9 national championships, more than any other program in the country. Meanwhile, Boston and Halifax have stayed connected. Every year, Nova Scotia sends a 50-foot, 2-ton Christmas tree to Boston as thanks for the city's help after the explosion.
3, 2, 1! Light that tree!
As for Joseph Bars, after finishing medical school, he became the chief of surgery at a veterans hospital in Chicago, then opened his own practice. Oh, and one last thing. Joseph Bars, great-grandson of the guy who sank all those American ships, wound up marrying a woman from Battle Creek, Michigan. He became an American citizen.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. For much more on the life of Joseph Bars and the events of December 6th, 1917, check out John Bacon's book, The Great Halifax Explosion. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from John Bacon, who offers yet another little-known historical tidbit from the history of Canadian-U.S. relations.
Al Capone, when he got caught running rum from Canada through the Great Lakes, his defense was, Canada, I don't even know what street it's on. And that worked.
I'm Bill Littlefield. We'll return next week with more sports NPR style and Only a Game. Thanks for listening.